Good evening. I'm Nicholas Brown Wilkinson. I am here to introduce somebody who is known to you all before I start talking, and therefore it's rather a waste of time. We'll get on to him very soon, I hope. Just a word about the Hamlin Foundation, which endows these lectures, or partly endows. It's a product of a formidable lady called Miss Hamlin, who died as long ago as 1941, leaving her not very large estate for the following purposes. Well, for a charity. And the object of the charity is the furtherance by lectures or other means among the capital C common, capital P people of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland of the knowledge of the comparative jurisdiction and ethnology of the chief European countries, including the United Kingdom, and the circumstances of the growth of jurisprudence, to the intent that the capital C common, capital P people of the United Kingdom may realize the privileges which in law and custom they enjoy in comparison with other European peoples, and realizing and appreciating such privileges may recognize the responsibilities and obligations attaching to them. A forebearer of William Hague, one feels, in her attitude to the unspeakable advantage of being English. That said, she has endowed a quite marvelous series of lectures, starting with Lord Denning in 1949 and going down through a remarkable line of lecturers, culminating, rightly, tonight in Professor Michael Zander's starting on this series of four lectures. Michael I've known for a very long time. He retired last year after 35 years at the LSE, been a professor here since 1977, published extensively and stimulatingly, if I may say so. He became Queen's Counsel Honoris Causa in 1997 and was the legal correspondent of The Guardian for very many years. He has views on civil justice and criminal justice and procedures. So it is altogether appropriate that tonight his opening lecture should be entitled, I believe, by slightly amended, Justice and Access to Justice. After he's spoken, he said that he will kindly take questions if anybody has some questions, which I'm sure they will. Professor Zander.
It's a great honour to be invited to give the Hamlin Lectures. The role of former lecturers in this series, including such names as Denning, Devlin, Kahn Freund, Glanville Williams, Scarman, is a glittering array. To be asked to join such an illustrious company is not only an honour, it's also a formidable challenge. The fact that these lectures, the 51st in the series, are given in the last days of the 20th century is also pregnant with overtones. I hope that the title for the series, The State of Justice, has about it the appropriate ring of significance for so portentous a moment in time. I'm delighted that it's been possible to arrange for all four lectures to be given here at the LSE, and I thank the school and the law department for this courtesy. I'm also most honoured that this lecture should be chaired by Lord Brown Wilkinson, the senior law lord, and attended by such a distinguished audience. This first lecture, entitled Justice and Access to Justice, will be followed by next week's lecture on civil justice, closely connected with tonight's topic, the third on criminal justice, and the last on human rights, with special reference to the Human Rights Act. The subject embraced by the title for the series, The State of Justice, is so vast that four lectures can do no more than scratch the surface. However broad the brush, one cannot even touch on, let alone treat, every relevant topic. My aim in these lectures has been to focus on as many as possible of the most important issues, but I'm very conscious that for reasons either of space or or lack of competence, or both, there are major issues that I do not address at all. In this lecture, for instance, I say nothing on the important and vexed issue of the quality of legal services. In my lecture on criminal justice, I say nothing about the race question, or victims, or the penal system. There are those who believe that the British justice system is the best in the world. And for all I know, it may be. But I've always resisted the temptation to make such a global statement about our system in comparison with others, because I find it impossible to evaluate our system as a whole, much less everyone else's. A legal system has an infinite number of working parts. To get a sense of a national system, one has to put as many as possible of those working parts under scrutiny. The right answer to the question whether the legal system in a particular country at a particular time is good or not so good is therefore to ask the question, in what respect? It's through the aggregate of detailed evaluations of the different parts of the system that one may eventually arrive at an overall conclusion. But for me, the overall conclusion is far less interesting than the detailed evaluations. For one person may emphasize the observed warts, where someone else who has seen exactly the same blemishes may emphasize other more benign features. One sees the glass half empty, another sees the glass half full. I would acknowledge that my own tendency over the years has been to focus more attention on the weak than on the strong features. By what criteria can one judge a legal system? My title suggests that one criterion is the quantity and quality of justice that it delivers, and if that could be ascertained, it would surely be the most important criterion of all. But I'm not sure that the question can be put meaningfully, let alone answered. The trouble is that we do not have any means for measuring the justice quotient in decisions of the courts. Take criminal cases. When a person is found guilty, we do not normally know whether he actually is guilty. Even when he pleads guilty, we cannot be sure that he committed the act in question. He might be completely innocent. When someone's acquitted, the press often refer to him as found innocent. But that's plainly wrong. Acquitted means only what it says, found not guilty, which might also be rendered not found guilty. How can one measure whether the verdict was just? Sometimes one does have a distinct sense that justice has been done in the individual case, though it also happens that that firm impression is sometimes later shown to have been completely mistaken. But I know of no way of assessing to what extent justice was done in a sample of cases, whether civil or criminal. The question is too elusive, too complex to unravel. It would require knowledge of too many unknowable facts. The concept of justice in legal cases, I suspect, is too deep for any research project. At all events, so far as I'm aware, it has never been attempted. We cannot therefore reach a view as to the proportion of cases in which courts reach a just result. One can ask the less demanding question whether the result was understandable in terms of the evidence, and attempts of that kind have been made. But even then, whose view is then being represented? The researcher could only form his own view if he was able to follow the whole case from start to finish, preferably including all its pre-trial stages. To do that for one case is difficult enough. To do it for even a small number of cases is in practice almost impossible. And to do it for a large sample is absolutely impossible. One can ask the participants in the case for their view, and that has been done. It provides an answer of sorts, but if one asks different participants, one naturally gets different impressions. Then where is the truth of the matter? I learnt the lesson in the Crown Court study, which I conducted for the Runciman and Royal Commission on Criminal Justice. We asked the different participants in a large sample of Crown Court cases to fill out questionnaires as soon as the case was concluded. It was remarkable how often they disagreed as to what had happened at the trial, even on simple questions of fact. If measuring what I'm calling the justice quotient in the system is impossible, it's equally vain to imagine that one can assess the injustice quotient. The Runciman Commission was established because even Mrs. Thatcher who despised royal commissions, had been persuaded that one was needed to deal with mounting public anxiety about miscarriages of justice, cases involving prosecution misconduct. This public anxiety had been generated by a handful of major cases, all, as bad luck would have it, involving IRA terrorism. The fact that concerns serious enough to cause the setting up of a royal commission were provoked by a tiny number of high-profile cases said more about political sensitivity than it did about the scale of the problem of miscarriages of justice. The Royal Commission considered trying to estimate how many persons in prison might be victims of a miscarriage of justice, but decided that there was no way in which such an estimate could be based on anything solid. The number of such cases, and therefore their statistical frequency, will always be unknowable. One might say that evidence that any such cases occur is sufficient. Since a legal system should not perpetrate miscarriages of justice, the fact that some occur is evidence that the system is failing. But this approach cannot be regarded as serious. No system can avoid making some mistakes. Even if the system was perfectly designed, there would always be the possibility of miscarriages of justice caused by human error in the form, for instance, of mistaken eyewitness evidence, or human wickedness, say, of lying witnesses. Also, what could be said to be a mistake may in fact be a better reflection of justice than a true verdict based on the law and the evidence. When the jury acquitted Clive Ponting or Pat Pottle and Michael Randall, some would say that the result was right, meaning just, even though the jury in both cases was clearly defying both the law and the evidence. Nor can the quotient of justice delivered by the system be measured sensibly by its outcomes. There is no right percentage of acquittals in criminal cases or of verdicts for the claimant in civil cases. Each national system will have its recognizable, typical current profile, which tends to be pretty consistent year on year. These national profiles vary from country to country. But again, the variations tell us nothing about the justice factor. So the fact that the English criminal justice system has a much higher proportion of acquittals than another could reflect different levels of justice obtainable in the two systems, but it may just reflect different systems of pretrial screening. Weak cases that in our system end with an acquittal may in other systems be weeded out at an earlier stage by a more rigorous system of pretrial scrutiny. Similarly, the fact that in our system juries acquit more often than magistrates does not establish that juries do more justice. We have no sound basis for judging that juries are right and magistrates are wrong. Leaving aside the question of evaluating the justice quotient, if one asks then by what criterion should one attempt to evaluate a legal system, there are many that are relevant. In the case of civil justice, for instance, the issues include how accessible is the system in terms of cost, simplicity of procedure and the geographical availability of courts, how bad are the delays, are there appropriate sticks and carrots to encourage out-of-court settlements? Are there alternative dispute resolution methods? Does the system for the listing of cases work with reasonable efficiency from the perspective both of the professionals and of witnesses? Is the system for enforcing judgment debts efficient? And there are equivalent questions in regard to criminal cases. In both civil and criminal cases, the fundamental question is whether the system holds the balance fairly between the parties, though the nature of the desired balance is somewhat different. In civil cases, the aim is that, so far as practicable, one should try to have a level playing field between the two sides. In criminal cases, it's accepted that fairness includes the principle that the playing field should be somewhat tipped in favor of the defendant, for instance, in regard to the burden of proof or pretrial disclosure. And the appropriate balance between the two sides has to be weighed in the light of the need for economy and efficiency. So in regard to criminal justice, on some topics, primary weight is given to the interests of the prosecution, sometimes called the crime control perspective. On others, to the interests of the suspect, sometimes called the due process perspective. And on others again, to the need for economy and efficiency. Inevitably, everyone brings to the task his or her own perspective. A civil libertarian strikes the balance differently from a police officer. It was difficult, for instance, to find amongst the 900 or more submissions of evidence to the Runciman Royal Commission any that were balanced in the sense of weighing pros and cons. Almost all of them set forth views and recommendations with no acknowledgement that there could be a plausible contrary opinion. Yet on most important questions, there are plausible alternative views. One hopes that the way is lighted by relevant empirical evidence, whether in the form of data collected on a regular basis, such as the annual criminal statistics or judicial statistics, or in the form of ad hoc studies. By comparison with many countries, we are relatively fortunate in the amount of information about the operation of the system that is available. And over the past 20 years or so, there's been a considerable increase in the amount of empirical research that is undertaken. Even the Lord Chancellor's Department, if I may put it that way, formerly laggard in undertaking or commissioning research, now commits funds on a worthwhile scale to this enterprise. Yet despite the undoubted improvement of recent years, it is remarkable how often one comes across a question on which there is either no or wholly inadequate information. It's even more remarkable how often government makes policy decisions in a state of blissful ignorance about important relevant facts. Whether one's views of these issues can helpfully be informed by formal guiding principles is a matter of opinion. The Runciman Royal Commission's report was criticized by some commentators for its failure to use principles embedded in the European Convention on Human Rights as one of its lodestars. I was not persuaded by this criticism. In my view, whether operating on one's own or in a committee with others, one brings to the question one's own values, knowledge, and experience. General principles, however relevant and weighty, will only be brought to bear to the extent that they are felt to be applicable to the particular question. That cannot be determined by the general principle. It's determined, rather, by how the individual feels about that problem in light of his knowledge and experience. So the civil libertarian may, on a particular topic, adopt the police officer's crime control perspective, and vice versa. In each case, it's not the general principle that produces the result, but the person's sense that on that topic, that is the right approach. These four lectures on the state of justice at the end of the millennium reflect the views of an academic lawyer who for many years has been a student of the workings of the legal system, and in particular of the system's pathology. The phrase access to justice has become a term of art, signifying the arrangements made by the state to ensure that the public at large, and especially those who are indigent, can obtain the benefits available through the use of law and the legal system. This country has been a leader in addressing that problem. In particular, we've had a legal aid system that is remarkable, both for its scope and for the fact that it involves so large a proportion of the legal profession. It was established as one of the great reforms introduced by the post-war Attlee government. The Legal Aid Act 1949, setting up the civil legal aid scheme, was a historic stage in the story of legal services for the poor. Over the past five decades, there have been many important developments in the legal aid scheme. But after 1949, unquestionably, the next most important milestone is 1999, exactly 50 years later, the Access to Justice Act of this year. Though the new act is a milestone of a very different kind. The 1949 Act was an opening of the door to justice for citizens. The 1999 Act has, in effect, erected a large notice over that door entitled Restricted Entry. The significance of that change is the main focus of this lecture. The essence of the system established by the 1949 Act was that if a citizen with a legal problem could establish that he or she qualified for legal aid under the means test and the merits test, he had an entitlement to legal aid. There was an annual budget approved by Parliament, but if the budget was exceeded, a supplementary grant was always obtained. The same concept applied to legal aid for criminal cases. If the court was satisfied that the defendant qualified under the means test and the merits test, it granted legal aid. And again, the taxpayer would foot the bill. In 1998, the bill was roughly £1.6 billion net. Not a small sum. From the 1980s onward, the rising cost to the taxpayer of the legal aid budget increasingly became a matter of political concern. Rightly or wrongly, and this is not the occasion for discussion of that issue, the previous Lord Chancellor, Lord Mackay, responded to pressure from the Treasury in a green paper in July 1995, in which he outlined radical proposals for altering the existing legal aid scheme. Of the many proposals in that green paper, by far the most important was that legal aid expenditure, instead of being demand-led and open-ended, should be capped or subject to a ceiling. Quote, "The legal aid scheme must operate within an overall fixed budget to create a discipline for setting priorities." This proposal provoked a fierce critical reaction from just about all lawyer and non-lawyer organizations concerned with the provision of legal services. But in July 1996, Lord Mackay, in a white paper, broadly confirmed the plans outlined a year previously in the Green Paper. One of the severest critics of Lord Mackay's proposals at the time was Lord Irvine of Lerg, then Shadow Lord Chancellor. Writing about Lord Mackay's proposals shortly before the 1997 general election, Lord Irvine quoted extensively from a public lecture I had given in this very auditorium at the LSE on today's subject, access to justice. He described the lecture as a devastating attack on the Green Paper, and he quoted with approval my conclusion that implementation of the Green Paper would cause incalculable harm to the legal aid scheme and would seriously diminish access to justice. But only a few months after the publication of his essay, Lord Irvine was himself the Lord Chancellor. And with little ado, he proceeded to implement Lord Mackay's reforms, adding, for good measure, a few further touches of his own, notably the withdrawal of legal aid from personal injury and other damages actions. He announced his plans a mere 5 months after taking office, and his, one might say ironically entitled, Access to Justice Bill was introduced a year or so later. Ministers of both this and the previous government were guilty on too many occasions of making unwarranted and gratuitous criticisms of the legal aid scheme and of legal aid lawyers, probably in the hope of garnering political support for the developing plans to dismantle the scheme. In my judgment, it will soon enough become apparent that the legal aid scheme we had was greatly to be preferred to what will now replace it. Under the new arrangements, legal aid is abolished, and the Legal Aid Board, which ran the system, is replaced by the Legal Services Commission. The board has deservedly won a fine reputation, both for administrative efficiency and for its imaginative approach to the development of publicly funded legal services. My criticisms of the new scheme are in no way directed at the board, which I believe is doing its utmost to make the best of the situation. The Legal Services Commission, which will take over the board's existing staff, will operate the system in respect of civil matters through the Community Legal Service, CLS, and in respect of criminal work through the Criminal Defence Service, CDS. The functions of the Commission include assessing local needs for legal services and having determined priorities in light of directions given by the Lord Chancellor to match funding to the identified needs. Determining needs in the abstract is obviously a poor alternative to being able to respond to actual needs manifested by real people. There will always be a mismatch between what is planned and what is actually needed. This would be so even if there were reliable, workable methods of measuring need for legal services, but that is not the situation. Measuring such needs is a fiendishly difficult business, and there is no agreed way of proceeding. The government's recent consultation paper on the Community Legal Service, for example, included an appendix purporting to quantify the unmet need for legal services in civil disputes. Having cited various statistics, the document concluded, quote, "The figures do not support the proposition that there is a widespread unmet need as a result of inadequate provision." a verdict that has been greeted by the experts with considerable surprise. On this topic, a major study by Professor Hazel Genn, to be published this Thursday, and to which I will return in my lecture next week, is a rather more reliable guide. But worse, the measuring of need will be done by different agencies using different means and methodologies, by the Legal Services Commission centrally, by each of the Commission's regional Legal Services Commissions, and by the community legal service partnerships that are being set up all over the country to bring together funders and providers of legal services at the local level. Assessment of unmet need for the community legal service is even to include unscientific studies in major shops such as Marks and Spencer, Asda, Dixon's, and the like. This does not look to me like assessment of need in a coherent and consistent way. The setting of a predetermined annual budget means, by definition, that there must be rationing to ensure that the budget is not overspent. The rationing of legal aid is an attack on access to justice. People who, under the old system, would have qualified on the means test and the merits test will be denied funding. Even someone who qualifies under the new tests will be denied service if the monies allocated to that service or that category of work have run out. That is the effect of having a controlled budget. The real reason for controlling the budget is obviously to placate the Treasury. But the stated reasons emphasize rather that it permits the targeting of resources. Thus, the government's white paper gave as the first objective of the new system that it should, quote, direct the available resources to where they are most needed, to reflect defined priorities. It's for this reason that the Lord Chancellor said he had decided to withdraw legal aid from some categories of work, notably personal injury cases. So far, the Lord Chancellor has designated two categories of priority. In top priority cases, the Commission must ensure that all cases are funded. This, for the moment, consists only of certain proceedings under the Children Act 1989, for which legal aid is available without a means test or a merits test, and civil proceedings in which the life or liberty of the subject is at stake. Priority is also to be given to the housing cases and other social welfare cases that enable people, and I quote, to avoid or climb out of social exclusion, domestic violence cases, cases concerning the welfare of children, and cases alleging serious wrongdoing, breach of human rights, or abuse of position or power by a public body or servant, such as a police officer. This second priority category will be exempt from the new cost-benefit rules for funding, which sounds excellent. But it's only an improvement on the previous system if cases in those categories are now to be funded which previously were not. But where are those cases, and by what methods are they going to be found? One method is simply to extend funding to new categories of work previously excluded from legal aid. The Lord Chancellor's very welcome recent decision to extend funding to representation before the immigration appellate tribunals is an example, but one imagines there will be few such block extensions. It's been estimated that the government's decision to withdraw legal aid from certain categories of work, notably personal injury cases, will save some £35 million. Even in the unlikely event that all that money were allocated to legal aid, legal services for priority cases, actually getting such cases so that they can be funded is quite a different matter. Moreover, could one rustle up larger numbers of priority legal problems without at the same time getting people to come forward in numbers with non-priority legal problems? And quite apart from these practical questions, there's also the question of principle, whether taxpayers' money should be used actively to drum up legal work. If that is not the intention, I doubt whether the additional monies notionally allocated to priority cases will in fact be used. A cynic might suggest that that is precisely what the government hopes will happen. One major uncertainty amongst many is the extent to which the budget for civil work is at risk of being diminished by the claims of the budget for criminal cases. The government has taken the point that capping the budget for criminal legal aid would be a breach of the European Convention on Human Rights, Article 6 of which guarantees free representation for those who cannot afford to pay for legal assistance. But there has not yet been a guarantee of ring fencing for the civil budget, and some of the parliamentary statements on the subject made by ministers during the passage of the bill were distinctly worrying. During the House of Lords committee stage, for instance, the Lord Chancellor said, and I quote, "The only money that is left for civil legal aid is what is left over out of that budget after the requirements of criminal legal aid have been met." Hitherto, all solicitors' firms have been able to undertake legal aid. In future, only those that have contracts from the Legal Services Commission will be permitted to do so. The effect of this will be drastically to reduce the number of outlets providing the service from around some 11,000 to some 5,000 to 6,000. One can expect clients to travel a certain distance to get advice and help with legal problems. But to more than halve the number of firms able to do publicly funded work is bound to have a harmful effect on the accessibility of legal services for many clients, and not only in rural areas. In future, there may not be more than a single contracted firm in a locality available to do particular categories of work. The Legal Aid Board said in April 1998 that in regard to family law, for instance, quote, "most centres of population of any significance should have at least one contracted firm with a second contracted firm within reasonable proximity." So smaller centres of population might not have more than one contracted practitioner to do family law work, which is mainstream work for most solicitors' firms. Presumably in less mainstream areas of work, there might only be a single contracted firm, even in centres of considerable significant population. Quite apart from the serious effect of the reduction in points of access for potential clients, the power of patronage wielded by the Legal Services Commission in deciding who does and who does not get a contract is frightening. The idea that bureaucracy will determine who can provide legal services and where is not a happy one. The allocation of contracts through block grants will be subject to competitive tendering. The December 1998 White Paper stated that contracting would, quote, "promote better value for money by providing the basis for competition and by fixing prices in a way that encourages greater efficiency." The obvious risk is that standards of service will decline, since whatever protestations are made about insistence on quality of work, the natural tendency will be to accept the lowest bids. Lord Irvine made the point when he was Shadow Lord Chancellor. Labour, he said, was against competitive tendering, quote, "because of the inevitable tendency to favour low-priced against higher quality bidders." The Legal Aid Board Research Unit has warned that American experience showed that competitive bidding created an incentive to weigh cost over quality. Contrary to the rhetoric, cost tended to go up whilst quality went down. Fixed price contracts resulted in case overload, less than adequate representation for clients, and instability as contractors were replaced from year to year. It also involved heavy administrative costs to process bids and negotiate contracts. The decision whether a particular client gets state funding for a civil case will be based first, as previously, on a means test. But the traditional merits test will be replaced by the new funding code. The old test was simple and was the same for all cases. In essence, were there reasonable prospects of success, and was it reasonable in all the circumstances that public money be used for the case? Under the new funding code, there will be different tests for different types of cases. The draft code said, quote, "rather than attempting to apply one universal test to a huge variety of civil cases, the new funding code has the flexibility to apply different criteria to different types of cases." It described the old test as vague and subjective. Instead, the new test would be clear and objective, with specific criteria in terms of prospects of success, costs, and damages. Where the claim is for quantifiable damages, the code will specify percentage bands of success and minimum cost-benefit ratios. So where prospects of success are very good, 80% or better, likely damages must exceed likely costs. Where the prospects are good, 60 to 80%, likely damages will have to exceed costs by at least 2 to 1. Where prospects are only fair, 50 to 60%, damages will have to exceed costs by at least 4 to 1. The Legal Aid Board's own recently published research shows that these cost-benefit requirements will mean that a very significant proportion of cases now funded by legal aid will no longer get funding. They estimate that about a fifth of legally aided cases with very good prospects of success, 80% plus, and over half the non-housing cases in the good prospects of success, 60 to 80% category, and in the moderate, 50 to 60% category, would not qualify. Those figures are very alarming. Moreover, the weight to be given to the new cost-benefit assessment seems wholly disproportionate, given that there cannot be any exactitude about percentage estimates of success, nor of likely costs, nor of likely damages. The suggestion that the new criteria are clear and objective, where the old test was vague and subjective, is therefore unconvincing. In fact, the new criteria are considerably more open to different interpretations than the simple old test, if only because of their immense complexity and of the number of factors that will have to be taken into account. The draft funding code said that the new structured approach using minimum cost or damage thresholds and ratios should, quote, encourage more consistency in decision making. I would say the exact opposite is the case. Also, under the new system, solicitors will have to take into consideration whether they can afford to take the case, having regard to its likely cost, in light of the firm's block grant. Firms will naturally be tempted to favour cases that maximise their profit margin, thus creating a new conflict of interest problem between the client and the lawyer. A person unable to get state-funded legal services and not rich enough to afford to fund the case himself may now look to finance his case by way of a conditional fee or no-win, no-fee agreement, under which the solicitor agrees that if the case is lost, he will not charge the client, whereas if it is won, he will charge a success fee calculated as a percentage of his costs. Under a conditional fee agreement, come to be known as a CFA, if the client wins the case, his solicitor gets his normal fee paid by the loser. On top of that, he can charge his own client the agreed success fee, which can be anything up to 100% of the costs, subject only to the proviso that the Law Society recommends that the lawyer should not take more than one quarter, 25%, of the client's damages. Incidentally, it's not clear whether this 25% cap will survive. CFAs, which have only been allowed since 1995, have been used mainly for personal injury cases. Solicitor members of the Law Society's personal injury panel, for what at least started as a modest premium, could additionally offer their clients insurance cover against the risk of losing, and therefore having to pay the other side's costs. Recently, these premiums have gone up very sharply and are no longer quite so attractive. When Lord Irvine announced in 1997 that legal aid was to be withdrawn from personal injury cases and that claimants would instead have to look for funding to conditional agreements, conditional fee agreements, the critics pointed to the danger that some claimants would not be able to find a solicitor willing to take their case on a conditional fee basis, and alternatively, that the insurance premium to cover the risk of losing might be prohibitively high. The Lord Chancellor responded by saying that viable cases would find a willing solicitor and that the insurance industry would market after the event insurance policies at sensible premiums to cater for most viable cases. The critics accused him of being naively over-optimistic. But Lord Irwin then came forward with an unexpected response to that problem. The Access to Justice Act 1999 provides that both the success fee and the insurance premium paid to cover the risk of losing are recoverable by the winner from the loser. When this is brought into effect next April, it will resolve some of the concerns over CFAs. But there will still be a variety of situations where great problems will remain. One is when the client cannot find lawyers willing to act on a CFA, even though it is a winnable case. Solicitors may, for instance, demand an unreasonably high chance of success before being willing to take on the case. Another is where there's no funding to pay the insurance premium. Many solicitors' firms, and especially smaller firms, most firms are small, may find it impossible to advance substantial insurance premiums, or for that matter, even fairly modest premiums, for large numbers of clients. Another is when no insurance cover can be arranged, for instance, because insurers have stopped covering that firm because its average success rate has slipped below some required percentage imposed by the insurance company, and the control exercise over the whole field of litigation by insurance companies through the development of CFAs is another concern. Another is where the client is being asked to pay disbursements that he cannot afford. Paying your own disbursements is the norm under a CFA. It's recently been announced that in heavy personal injury cases, or when a great deal of investigation is needed, the Legal Services Commission will be able to pay part of the costs, including the insurance premium and disbursements. This is extremely welcome news, but it will apply only to a small minority of cases. The Civil Justice Council, giving its verdict on the government's proposals, recently said, "We are concerned that funding plans appear to rely heavily on CFAs and insurance to fill significant gaps in provision. Such assumptions," it said, "are premature." Certainly, the overall effect of making success fees and insurance premiums recoverable will be to increase the cost of litigation for losing defendants, which no doubt will be reflected soon enough in higher insurance premiums for us all. It's equally predictable that the level of both success fees and premiums for insurance policies to cover CFAs will rise, which would have a further inflationary effect on the costs of litigation, and would incidentally bring solicitors undeserved windfall profits from CFAs. The loser will have the right to ask for a review of the level of both the success fee and of the premium, but it may not be easy to establish that the lawyer's early estimate of risk was too high. Also, challenge of the level of the success fee and of the insurance premium will in practice generally not occur in cases that settle, as of course most do. The overall impact of CFAs on the economies of litigation will therefore be very great. Among the many wholly unpredictable issues is to what extent changes in the pattern of funding through the withdrawal of legal aid and the development of CFAs will bring in new clients. Another unpredictable feature of the new funding arrangements under the Access to Justice Act is what impact will be made by the new initiatives to be taken by the Community Legal Service, the CLS. To judge from the emphasis it's given them, the government apparently regards these as very important. The overwhelming bulk of CLS expenditure of the order of some £800 million a year will obviously go, as before, in providing the services of solicitors and barristers in private practice, above all in family law matters, though now it will be under the new contractual arrangements. Expenditure on the new initiatives will, by comparison, be minuscule. It was announced recently with fanfares that of the annual £200 million plus expenditure on green form advice and assistance, which in future is to be known as legal help, £20 million will be reserved for contracting by the CLS with the not-for-profit sector, a relatively modest sum, hardly any of which is in fact new money. Given the balance of funding between the private and the not-for-profit sector, it's strange, verging on bizarre, that in the consultation paper on the Community Legal Service and in the innumerable statements made on the CLS by government ministers, there's hardly been a mention of the basic mainstream function of funding done by and for legal private practitioners. All the emphasis has been on the fancy new aspects of the service in the not-for-profit sector. A recent speech by the Lord Chancellor summarized the main themes. The Community Legal Service, he said, is the first attempt ever by any government to deliver legal services in a joined-up way. It will provide a framework for comprehensive local networks of good quality legal and advice services, supported by coordinated funding and based on the needs of local people. A variety of initiatives are being taken to promote the concept of what are grandly being called joined-up legal services. One is the establishment of a CLS website with the aim of assisting both providers of advice and those of their clients who have access to the internet. It will be particularly valuable to people who, because of disability or distance, cannot easily reach an advice center or other advisor. The internet can be used to disseminate information about available facilities, about legal problems, and about how to handle them. In the short term, the website will be stronger in providing information than in giving advice. In the longer run, it may develop expert systems or intelligent checklists, enabling at least the more skilled and the more intelligent to obtain do-it-yourself legal advice. With internet access spreading rapidly, these developments are to be welcomed. But for some time to come, it will probably remain the case that internet access will be heavily affected by class differences. A recent survey showed that whereas a third of people in classes A and B had access to the internet at home, the proportion for classes D and E was 2%. And the fact that one has access to the web at home does not mean that one either feels or is competent to use it, even just for the purpose of seeking information about legal problems, as opposed to booking a holiday, let alone for the much more demanding task of trying to get advice or assistance. I speak with feeling as someone who still hasn't quite mastered the art of programming a video recorder. The internet is not the only way of deploying information technology in this field. Public access terminals using interactive video technology in court foyers or public libraries seem to be a useful and cost-effective way of providing information and guidance. One advantage is that such information can be provided in different languages. But again, many of the most vulnerable have poor literacy skills and will not be well placed to take advantage of such aids. Apart from the use of information technology, the CLS is planning to develop a variety of alternative approaches to promoting access to help with legal problems, for instance, through telephone, mobile, and other services, including specialist second-tier advice services provided to advisors. So, for instance, a pilot scheme starting in the year 2000 will make free specialist help available over the telephone to solicitors and advice agencies in the fields of social welfare law, immigration, and human rights. The Legal Aid Board has for some years been exploring ways of bringing the not-for-profit sector into the scheme for providing help with legal problems. This is an important aspect of the plans for the Community Legal Service. The task of coordination of the different systems for helping citizens with their legal problems will fall to the new CLS partnerships. These partnerships will be between the CLS, local government, and other funders of advisory services, together with representatives of the providers of those services. As has already been noted, the partnerships are supposed to identify the level of unmet need for legal services, and they are supposed then to map existing provision of services and to devise improved networks to plug gaps in local provision and better referral systems to ensure that the person with the problem reaches the appropriate advice. Six pioneer areas are testing out the partnership concept, and 40 other local authorities are involved as associate pioneers. Local initiative is to be encouraged, but best practice guidance will be circulated in the hope of promoting it on a nationwide basis. These plans sound promising, but they raise many questions. Since there's no compulsion on local authorities to participate effectively or at all, how can laggard authorities be made to play their part? Equally, how can local authorities that are currently funding legal services be prevented from withdrawing or reducing such funding when they see that central government monies are now to be available? The best way might be to put local authorities under a statutory obligation to fund advice provision similar to the duty under the Housing Act 1996 to provide advice and information about homelessness free of charge. Again, how likely is it that different funders will be able to agree on who is to provide and to pay for particular services? The Legal Aid Board says that each local partnership, quote, will form a funding group which will make the final recommendations on funding within each partnership arrangement for final approval by the relevant individual funding bodies. But since each funding body will be able to take its own decisions, will the talk of coordinated funding amount to very much? It's difficult to imagine different providers working for different agencies agreeing on rationalization of the services, where what is meant is elimination or downgrading of their own activities. What, for that matter, does rationalization in this context actually mean? To take an example, how does the plan for a CLS website providing information fit with the new Citizens Advice Bureau's advice guide website? The numbers of users of this new CAB service reached 2,000 a week shortly after its launch and is expected to grow rapidly. The National Association of Citizens Advice Bureaus is currently exploring with other organizations of the Advice Services Alliance the possibility of a joint initiative to ensure that there is a single point of access to reliable, up-to-date, and accurate information which avoids duplication and makes effective use of resources. It would be extremely unfortunate if the plans for these two national systems were not synchronized. But it's easier to speak of coordination than actually to achieve it. Another large question is how gaps in service provision can be filled if there is no new money. There are, for instance, some 50 law centers. Supposing assessment of need suggested that another 50 were required, is it conceivable that the money would be forthcoming to set them up? Obviously not. And then again, how will the community legal service be able to avoid unacceptable differences in levels of service at the local level? On the other hand, trying to even out provision by the transfer of monies from one area to another, or from one service to another, means by definition that need that is currently being met would no longer be met. There is no way of squaring this circle. The consultation paper says that in order to achieve proper referral between advisors and the most effective deployment of resources in a particular neighborhood, quote, it will be very important for formal working agreements or concordats to be drawn up among all the various bodies involved in each area. These will set out standing arrangements for their mutual cooperation in the advice they give and the services they provide. My concern is that these formal working agreements or concordats for referral may become rigid new demarcation lines that work to the client's disadvantage. Having elaborate arrangements designed to direct clients with legal problems, quote, to the right advisor, may actually be counterproductive. At present, there is a wide range of choice: lawyers in private practice and in law centers, citizens advice bureaus, consumer advice centers, housing aid centers, neighborhood centers. They can all make a contribution to sorting out people's legal problems. The College of Law has just announced that it plans to establish a nationwide network of free legal advice clinics staffed by law students under the supervision of practitioners and teachers. I see no reason why that should not also play a part. The great variety of overlapping potential sources of information, advice, and assistance is an enormous benefit to the citizen with the problem. It would be churlish to be against mutual cooperation and better communication between agencies, or even greater efficiency in referral systems, if that achieves a better balance between generalist and specialist agencies in a locality and the filling of gaps in the provision of services, so much the better. But formal working agreements or concordats between agencies could stifle rather than facilitate. The crucial factor in all of this is that there will be no additional money for legal services. Without new resources, it will be difficult to achieve anything of great consequence beyond rearranging the deck chairs. Will worthwhile amounts of money actually become available for reallocation to new legal services uses? And if so, will those new uses turn out to be a better application of public money? The fact that the project is being written up by politicians in glowing terms, that there are attractive champions to blow the trumpet, that some enthusiasm is being generated, and that valiant preparatory work is being done, does not establish that it will. Certainly, there are some interesting developments that could bear worthwhile fruit. But the plans for the Community Legal Service are still vague and incoherent. For the moment, I prefer to reserve judgment as to whether the potential gains from the new arrangements will compensate in any way for the certain losses. I fear that they will not. The truth is that the government's reforms spring not from a desire to improve access to justice, but from the Treasury's need to control the budget. The entire new system flows from the decision to cap the budget. This will infect the whole enterprise. The point was seen by Lord Irvine himself, writing when he was still in opposition. Capping, he said, signifies an abandonment of an entitlement basis for the grant of legal aid based on merits. Legal aid will cease to be a benefit to which the individual who qualifies is entitled. It will in practice become a discretionary benefit available at bureaucratic disposal, a benefit which will have to be disallowed when the money runs out or when another category of cases has been given funding preferences. Lord Irvine alluded to the arguments put forward at the time by the Conservative government and the Legal Aid Board to allay fears as to how the new system would work. There is much sophistry, he said, about the contracts with the suppliers being for different periods and long periods, so that no one in practice need be excluded. That, he said, was not persuasive. Capping, he said, is crude. Legal aid will cease to be a service available on an equal basis nationally. Cases will go forward in one region where identical cases in others of equal merit will not because of capping. In practice, capping will lead at worst to substantial exclusion from justice and at best to long waiting lists. Typically, legal aid is sought at times of crisis for the individual. Its availability, Lord Irvine said, should not depend on the accident of where the individual lives or when application is made. Just so. My sentiments exactly. The Lord Chancellor and government ministers have been trying to persuade us that the plans for the Community Legal Service amount to something exciting and positive. I fear that this is a case of first creating darkness and then whistling in it. Thank you.
Now, has anybody got any questions for Professor Zander?
Or comments?
Could people identify?
Yes. Yeah, could you identify yourself?
My name is Bernberg, solicitor in private practice until earlier this year. Thank you. Solicitor in private practice until earlier this year when I retired, just about the same time as Professor Zander. I share entirely his views, his critique of the government measures that are now embodied in the Access to Justice Act. And indeed, I've been saying exactly the same for the last 2 years, just ever since the government took office. It seems to me that, and this is what I've been advocating, that by destroying the universality of access that was a basic of the old legal aid scheme, we are running the risk of seriously contravening Article 6 of the European Convention. It may be that legal aid is going to be guaranteed as required by the first part of Article 6 for criminal cases. But the government is running the severe risk, it seems to me, of running foul of the equality of arms provision of Article 6, which is inherent in Article 6, in civil cases. And as soon as the Act is operative next year, I think it's next October, there are bound to be challenges brought under the Human Rights Act of inadequacies in the whole scheme. Now, I've been saying this for some time, and it seems to me that what we really need in this country is something on the analogy of the National Health Service. What I've been pressing for with government and outside government is a salaried legal service which is funded not entirely by government, the taxpayer, because one has got to accept that no government in present circumstances is going to provide the finance in the way that it was provided.
I'm sorry
for
to. Could you keep this fairly short?
Yes,
because we have limited time. We get to a question or something.
Well, I would like to know what Professor Zander thinks about the idea of a salaried legal service funded in part by the private client. In other words, doing quite a lot of the private client work that is at present done by solicitors and barristers.
Well, I'll give a very brief answer to a question, a very broad question, which deserves a long answer. But my short position, briefly to say what my position is I see the state salaried sector as supplementary to, rather than in substitution for, the private sector. I value greatly the fact that we have 11,000 firms of solicitors providing services to all their clients. And I see great difficulties about asking the taxpayer to fund those services, or even most of those services, whereas I certainly see a case for state-salaried lawyers filling the gaps, and that was the essence of the original proposal made in Justice for All in 1968, when we put forward the idea for law centres, which, of course, you, Ben, know all about. So that, in brief, is where I would stand on that.
District judge and alumnus of LSE. Overall, what you've described to us happening in the legal world and the profession is really the exit from justice. Can I draw to your attention, I imagine in your speech next week, the effect of increasing of court fees? Because one of the successes in the last 10 or 15 years has been the small claims court. Vast numbers of small claims have been heard quickly and generally acceptably to people. But with the imposition now of a flat fee of £80 at the intermediate stage, of course it means that if you're the local builder, plumber, or indeed local citizen with a problem with your tradesmen and professionals, you pay out, say, £20 for a small claim up to £200, that about, but you're then asked for £80 later on.
Mm.
It's madness, and I do hope you'll perhaps be mentioning that.
I will definitely mention it next week. It's already in so far as the remarks next week are already written, that's a passage which is already written.
Yes. I'm Sam Roxburgh. I'm a first-year undergraduate law student at LSE.
Doesn't look like it.
Professor Zander, I wonder if you could tell me what the situation is where legal aid is helping a defendant who loses, where the claimant has a conditional fee arrangement. Will legal aid there then pay the costs, including the uplift and any insurance costs? Thank you.
Well, of course, if it's a conditional fee arrangement, there won't be any legal aid at all. That's the first problem. Yes, an action brought by a conditional fee plaintiff against a legally aided defendant.
Exactly.
I need notice of that question. It's I frankly can't quite remember what the answer to that is. See me afterwards.
Yeah, I think his fee is very moderate on that. Yes.
James Gibbons, barrister. Now, the practical question on conflict of interest, which you touched on. Does your research
and knowledge of other jurisdictions which have CFAs and no win, no fee agreements lead you to any conclusion at all as to the erosion of trust between bench and advocate through the failure to observe the duty, continuing duty of disclosure, which exists right up to judgment and I believe, according to a recent Court of Appeal decision, even thereafter? In the appellate process, so that in those jurisdictions, is there evidence that trust is eroded by the practice of shredding documents or not bringing them to light to the court in which you appear?
Well, I'm not aware of any such evidence, which doesn't mean it doesn't happen, of course. It would be difficult to find such evidence. I don't suppose that a survey would be capable, really, of reaching the problem. It's often said that conditional fee arrangements, or indeed contingency fee arrangements, were very close indeed now to embracing contingency fee as opposed to conditional fees. There's still a certain amount of shock horror about contingency fees, but I think that's going to evaporate over the next few years. And personally, I see, from an ethical point of view, no distinction at all between the two. So there is an argument that conditional or contingency fees might bring in question the ethics of the lawyer who's employed by a client and he doesn't get his fee unless he wins, and might that tempt him into unethical behavior. I'm not aware that there's any evidence about that one way or the other.
Hello, I'm Rob Blackett. I'm an undergraduate student at UCL, and I'm very sympathetic to your objections to cost capping, but I wonder whether, in the light of burgeoning costs of legal services, you recognise any need at all for reform of the legal aid service in that respect?
Well, it's a very interesting question, and I'm not going to try and answer it properly, because it would require, obviously, a long, complicated answer. What I would say about it is that there was a report made shortly after this government came into power by Sir Peter Middleton, who was asked by the Lord Chancellor to advise him about what to do in regard to the Wolf reforms and what to do about the Mackay plans for legal aid reform. And in his verdict on the legal aid reforms, he said that despite the increases of recent years and significant increases in the cost of legal aid, he was of the opinion, he was the person who ran the Treasury, the senior civil servant of the Treasury. His opinion was that the controls that were required in regard to the expenditure of legal aid were possible, could be achieved, without having a cap. And my analysis is that if we'd followed the Middleton advice on that point, we'd be in a much better position than we now are. It's the fact of the cap that's causing many of the problems that I've identified. So without getting into the pros and cons of whether Middleton was right or wrong, I just draw your attention to that verdict by Treasury Mandarin.
What else?
That was an excellent analysis. I'm not a lawyer at all, but I am concerned with social justice. I wanted to ask you whether you have done anything to bring your concerns to popular attention, i.e. have you done any press to raise those concerns in the public arena where it needs to be?
Well, it's a kind question, and the answer is yes.
hard to think of anybody who's been more in the public eye in this sort of area. Read your Times today, and he's at it again now. Is it time to begin then? Are there more questions? Yes.
John Power, I'm not a lawyer, but I'm very interested in the law. Do you see us as an Alexander where perhaps two PLC heavyweights fighting it out in the civil court, perhaps the loser should not only pay for the winner's legal costs, but perhaps the loser should be perhaps paying the full court costs, and perhaps wealthy criminals should also be paying for the full costs? Can we not get a greater contribution, accepting that in society we do have public sector transport and health and education, and perhaps we should have free legal services? But it does seem, when we get these very, very heavy civil trials, that why the state should pick up the tab.
Well, to anticipate a topic that I'm actually going to be dealing with next week, which the gentleman over on my right already alluded to, the problem of civil fees. In fact, the government have for some time now come to the opinion, wrongly in my view, that the civil litigant should pay the whole costs of civil justice, the whole cost, not just some of the costs. And that is now in place. That policy is already in place. So you're well served by this government and its predecessor in that regard. In regard to criminal legal aid, again, this is a point I'll just mention rather than dealing with when I come to talk about criminal justice. This government has, I believe, rightly decided that the endless business of means testing and trying to get contributions out of criminal defendants is a total fiasco, out of all proportion to its utility. The total expenditure on criminal legal aid is of the order of about £700 million. The total recovery by way of contributions is of the order of about £2 million. So it's a complete and absolutely fatuous waste of time. This government has finally grasped that nettle, which governments have ducked now for many, many years, and have got themselves into terrible trouble, because every year the Controller and Auditor General comes along and says you qualifies the accounts by saying you're not doing the means testing properly. Year in, year out, you're not doing the means testing. Finally, the Lord Chancellor has said enough of all this, no more means testing at the beginning of the case, but we will have a power for the court to order that a particular defendant on the evidence of the case, obviously got means, should pay substantial costs towards prosecution and defence. So I think, on the whole, the government's looking after your concern.
One more, yes, a final question here.
I'm Jason Sheng. I'm a postgraduate student, come from Hong Kong. I have some personal experience to serve in some kind of legal aid service in Hong Kong, and after I hear the speech of Professor Sand, I absolutely agree that the accessibility of to legal aid is the best possible objective test to see whether justice is accessible to the most part of the society. But I do think that the quality of legal service is indeed another very important point of assessing whether justice is accessible to those vulnerable parties. Because I think legal aid is, when we talked about legal aid, we are talking about some really vulnerable parties. They may not have adequate knowledge about whether the service provided to them are indeed some kinds of satisfactory in terms of an advanced legal system like UK can provide. Therefore, although at the very beginning Professor Sanders said you will not address on the issue of the quality of legal service, I'd like to have your comment maybe a little bit about that of UK. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm extremely grateful for that opportunity of saying a word on the subject, which is so important, and you're right that it's vital. And I think my comment would be this. Nobody doubts the importance of quality legal services, and if we ourselves were the client, the only thing we would want would be a quality legal service. No question about that. Everybody would adopt that position. However, there is now massive evidence going back over years that sufficiently adequate, services can be provided by people who at first sight don't look as if they're going to be able to provide a quality legal service. If I may start by mentioning the Citizens Advice Bureaus. The Citizens Advice Bureaus provide advice to something over 6 million people per year on a nationwide basis, free of charge. It's a highly valued, much appreciated service, and most of the people who provide that service are lay people. Lay people, they're not lawyers at all, but a great part of the work that they do is advising people with legal problems, and on the whole, adequately. Now, not as well as your QC would advise, maybe, but adequately, and that's the crucial thing, good enough. I mentioned in my remarks the initiative, which I applaud, of the College of Law, which is coming forward with this idea that young law students, that means postgraduate, trainees in the profession, should offer free legal services on a nationwide basis in free legal advice clinics. I think that's terrific, and I think they'll do a good job, and I think the clients they serve will be well served. There's plenty of experience in other countries, North America particularly, of legal services being provided by undergraduate or graduate law students. Adequate, perfectly adequate, and indeed in some cases even better than the services being provided in the private profession, not because the people themselves are better, but because the time that they have, the supervision that they have, the enthusiasm that they have for the work that they're doing, for example, in some American law schools for prisoners, legal advice for prisoners. Outstanding work and to be highly commended by people who are not even qualified. So the idea that they've got to be highly qualified, they've got to be franchised, they've got to have jumped through all sorts of fancy hoops that the Legal Services Commission, the successor to the Legal Aid Board, establishes in order to provide an adequate service is nonsense. It really is nonsense. And not only nonsense, it's dangerous nonsense in that it deprives people who are perfectly capable of providing a service of the opportunity of providing it simply because they haven't got the ticket, they haven't got the particular license, which is now going to be absolutely crucial. The franchise, which is going to be available only from the Legal Services Commission to provide legal services out of public monies. This is a disaster.
Can I now try and bring this to a close and by expressing our gratitude to Michael Zander? I first knew him, not very well at those stage, when I think he was in his 20s still, and he went in punching on the Inns of Court, who in those days were nearly as forward-looking a body of men as they now are. And he won. I think I'm right in saying he wanted them to publish their accounts, which didn't seem a wholly unreasonable step, and I believe in the end Michael won that battle. Ever since, he's been taking radical views, expressing radical views, based on real research and real knowledge. And we have tonight heard another of those, where he's looking at the whistle-in-the-wind type stuff coming from the Lord Chancellor's Department, and is really analyzing what is involved and is really pointing out what may be the hazards. I'm not saying I agree with everything he said, but I agree with a lot of it. I think we must all be extremely grateful to him for doing this and for making us think about things which otherwise might slip by unnoticed. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.